Hi everyone, Lachlan Peters here, and as you can tell, I am back in Phnom Penh. It's been far too long, it's been almost 8 years, but now I'm back and I'm really loving it. I'm doing research for my book and of course for the podcast, but today I just wanted to do an introduction for today's special guest for another bonus episode of the podcast. Now, as you'll know if you've been listening since the start of Season 3, we've really been exploring the post-1970 period where the country really fully enters into the years of war and destruction that engulf Cambodia. And today's guest, Jim Laurie, was there to witness it firsthand. As you'll hear in our discussion, Jim was on the ground in Vietnam at the same moment that Cambodia became a new front in the wider conflict. His insights connect directly with what we've been talking about on the show and add a vivid personal perspective that I'm really grateful he was able to share with me. Jim's story is also a personal one. One about a young man who stumbled into war reporting, fell in love, and tried to make sense of a society sliding into catastrophe. Earlier this year, I read his memoir, The Last Helicopter, and we'd been talking about having a conversation for a while. We did finally have one, which was unfortunately lost due to a technical mishap. But when we finally were able to reconnect, I think this conversation is even better than the first one. Now, a quick note to begin with. If you're listening on Spotify or Apple Podcasts or any of the other sort of audio mediums that you might usually listen to the podcast on, I would really recommend sort of maybe going to the YouTube channel for this particular episode especially. There's lots of visuals, footage, some of Jim's own material, and it really brings the story to life. So if you are just listening on audio, you might hear the occasional pause, and obviously in the video, that's where visuals are being shown. So completely up to you, but if you did want to listen on YouTube or watch on YouTube, this would be the one to do it. I would also really recommend picking up Jim's book. It is available as an audiobook as well, and it is read by himself, which I always think sort of adds like an extra authenticity. So if you have Audible, consider using one of your monthly credits on it or buying it outright, because it is a fantastic story where Jim provides a very honest account. He doesn't shy away from self-criticism, guilt, and the doubts that for a young man in his 20s was facing during such an extreme period of history. And it's not only Jim's story, it's also the story of a young Cambodian woman who had to face the horrors of the Khmer Rouge regime. Jim reported on Cambodia throughout the Civil War, but he also was reporting from Saigon in the Vietnam War, and he was in Phnom Penh in April of 1975 as the Americans pulled out, leaving the country to an uncertain fate. And after this, he actually traveled to Saigon to cover the end of the Vietnam War as well. So this is someone with a wealth of personal experience and a really valuable conversation to have. And as I mentioned, a great book. I think you'll really enjoy this interview. I certainly did. I got a lot out of it. And again, if you can, maybe watch this one on YouTube, because I really think it brings it to life. All right. Thanks, guys. And here we go. I'm here with Jim Laurie. How's it going, Jim?
Very well, sir. Very well. Brilliant. Great to hear that and great to have you back. Okay, so I've given the audience a little background to how your work got started in Vietnam and Cambodia back in 1970, and listeners will be familiar with how chaotic that year was, especially after April and the incursion. But I'm really interested in getting your personal on-the-ground perspective, as it were. So I'm curious, mate, all these years later, what memories stick out about those first few months, and sort of how did you get there? What were your impressions, particularly of Cambodia, man?
Well, as you say, things were very chaotic when I arrived. First of all, I was probably the greenest reporter ever in the Vietnam War theater. I didn't know anything really about war, had never covered a war before, had never had a major news story before. I was basically a university dropout in Asian studies in Washington, D.C., came out to Asia, managed to get myself a job with a small radio network and came into Vietnam first. I didn't get to Vietnam until April of 1970. And within the first month that I was there, Richard Nixon goes ahead and decides that he's going to send U.S. troops into Cambodia. And so my first experience with Cambodia, the first week of May of 1970, was going into the Chup rubber plantation with the 1st Air Cavalry. And it was just intense. I didn't see very much of Cambodia. I saw a lot of people running around shooting, and my helicopter that I was in was shot at, and I lost my breakfast that morning during one of the combat missions that I was on. And so that was sort of, it was baptism by fire and knowing very, very little about what I was getting into as Nixon ordered his incursion, as he called it, invasion, as I called it, of Cambodia. Then it was later that month in May that I got my first chance to go into Phnom Penh. It was a drive from Saigon to Phnom Penh. That road, Highway 1, was fairly dangerous at the time. There had been a number of journalists attacked. I think one or two had disappeared on that road, but that was the road that many of us took to get into Phnom Penh. So you would, I went with several colleagues. We got to the Vietnamese border, then to Nick Lung. In those days, there was no Japanese bridge across the Mekong River. We got into the ferry at Nick Lung and made our way across the river. And if we were lucky, we could get to Phnom Penh by about noon, 1 p.m. in time for lunch. There was this jumble of contradictions that I would say confronted me on my first visit to Phnom Penh in May of 1970. First of all, I mean, it was still a very small, sleepy city, maybe what, 500, 600,000 people. It still had that French air of a provincial capital, if you will. The beautiful architecture was pretty much intact. The church, the French buildings, the Lycée, all of that pretty much the way it had been from French colonial times. And we always referred to the gentle Khmer. You know, they were friendly, they were the smiles, and they were still very much smiles in May of 1970. But yet there was also that contradiction, because in the month before I got there, there were the brutal killings of thousands of Vietnamese. And I think you've done a podcast on the Vietnamese slaughter and the bodies coming down the Mekong River, hands tied behind their backs. So there was this murderous side of the Khmer personality. And I didn't see that directly. It had happened just before I got there, but it was clearly on the minds of people in the city at that time. And I made friends very quickly in Phnom Penh. I met a young doctor who became a friend. He was working at the Calumet Hospital. I met my best friend at a military briefing, Sok Sinan, and she was the woman I fell in love with there in Phnom Penh in those early days of 1970. Just going to the military briefing was so unlike what it was over in Vietnam. I'd only been in Saigon for a month, but already you could feel the war weariness of the Vietnamese. You would go to a military briefing. They had moved the military briefings in Saigon out of the old Rex officers' quarters into another building so they could accommodate more easily the South Vietnamese point of view and the South Vietnamese briefers, as Nixon kept talking about Vietnamization of the war in Vietnam. But over in Cambodia, the briefings were held in a upstairs bank building at first. And there was a little coffee shop. And you'd go in and you'd have your morning café au lait and a croque monsieur. And it was almost a lighthearted feeling to it. Chong Song, I met, who was the deputy military briefer, and of course, the legendary man in charge of briefings with the unlikely name of Am Rong. And it was extraordinarily different from Vietnam because the war really had not sunk in those early days in Phnom Penh. There was a lot of fighting. You would go to the briefing, you'd hear what was going on, and then you'd get into your car and drive out one of the highways to the south or to the northwest or to the east to see what was going on. And but it was almost, they were playing at war, it seemed to me at the time in May of 1970. There was the strange censorship. I was impressed by many of the students that I met at the University of Phnom Penh were all rah, rah, rah for the Khmer Republic, good riddance to Sihanouk. There was this air of optimism, constant optimism in Phnom Penh at that time. Yeah, it's going to be all right. Everything will be fine. We've got rid of Sihanouk. Everything is great. And they had employed a young university student at the post office to be the censor. And if you were a journalist in those days, you'd have to file your stories, as I did, either radio or print stories, in the old PTT, which is still there. The building's still there, and most of the buildings around that area are still as they were back in 1970. I lived in the Hotel de la Poste across the street. It was much cheaper than the Royal Hotel or the renamed Le Panam Hotel. I think the Panam was like $18, and I could only afford five, so I stayed at the Hotel de la Poste. Made it easy. I could go out and do my stories and come back and file. But this student, he was my censor, but not a very serious censor. He would look over my copy and let me go. There used to be a correspondent there named Ivor Peterson of the New York Times in 1970, and I met him. And Ivor did a story on the Cambodian black market and took his story into the censor. And the student said, you really shouldn't say black market. And so Ivor said, well, what do you want to call it? Well, why don't you call it white market? And so it was changed in the copy to white market. And of course, the New York Times in New York changed it back to black market. But it was sort of this nothing was terribly serious, it seemed to me. And there were the wonderful nightclubs on the river, the floating clubs. I mean, it was a very vibrant city on the other hand, sleepy but vibrant at the same time. And for a while it did not change. By the time that I stopped covering Phnom Penh on a regular basis in the end of 1972, it was very, very different. By that time, the refugees began to come into the city. The so-called Olympic Stadium became the center for relief agencies and the refugees. I still have photographs from 1972 of the Olympic Stadium there. And it had a much more serious flavor by 1972. But in those early months, I have to say, I guess it was in June of 1970 that I felt that things were really going to go wrong. June was the month that Siem Reap Airport was captured by the North Vietnamese. And my girlfriend and I had planned to go see Angkor. And with the airport taken by the North Vietnamese in June, our plans for my birthday, as it was, my 23rd birthday outing to Siem Reap, were going to be canceled. And then one by one, you saw the provincial capitals being taken, and you saw the impact of the invasion, of course, was to push the North Vietnamese deeper into Cambodia and to begin to train up, if you will, the Khmer Rouge. I never even heard of the Khmer Rouge when I first arrived in Phnom Penh. I never heard the name Pol Pot, certainly, or Salat Sar in those days. I know some did know of Salat Sar, but not those of us who were new to the Cambodian scene. But I guess the overall impression that I had in those early days was one of, it was almost innocence. It was a people who had managed somehow to stay out of war from 1954 onward. They avoided the horrors of Vietnam, the horrors of the Tet Offensive in 68. And they were not at all ready for a war. I remember in 1971, I was over in Saigon. I had Christmas of 70 and New Year's of 70 in Phnom Penh, then flew back to Saigon. And then roughly the middle of January of 71, the North Vietnamese attacked Pochentong Airport, wiped out the entire Cambodian Air Force, which was once dubbed the Royal Flying Club. And I think it was 61 or 69 airplanes were destroyed. Virtually everything was destroyed. They had some Air Force up in Battambang, but it was the clearest sign then this was not going to end well. And yet I went out to the airport and still found optimistic Khmer who were part of the Air Force. Oh, we'll rebuild again. The Americans will give us stuff. Of course, they always said the Americans will give us this. The Americans will do this. And of course, the Americans were not going to do any such thing. They were not going to give the Cambodians what they really needed to fight the war.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so you sort of mentioned there that you are going back and forth between Saigon and Phnom Penh, and this is over a period of years. And you've also set up sort of the naivete of sort of the Cambodian general perspective on this war that they've just sort of fallen into. I'm wondering, you mentioned at the start there that there was a lack of seriousness there, but I'm wondering, on each subsequent visit to Phnom Penh, or I believe you also get to visit the, not the the proper countryside, but you do get to leave Phnom Penh. I'm wondering, how did you start to yourself see that the war was changing this country? Like, I imagine it would be like, yeah, coming back and suddenly there's more barbed wire when there wasn't, or you couldn't get a certain item at the store or something like that. I'm wondering, yeah, how did you personally see that this country was changing?
Well, it was really a matter of where you could go. When I first arrived in May, I think it was June, maybe early June, that I managed to travel down to Sihanoukville, which was renamed Kampong Som. And in those days, you could still take the road. I took Highway 4 down through the Carbon Mountains, no issues. Got down to Sihanoukville, Kampong Som, looked around, sleepy little beach town. They had one hotel, I think it was. I was back in Sihanoukville last year, and I just couldn't believe how crazy it is there. But in those days, it was a sleepy little town. I think the biggest thing that was a problem is that the Vietnamese had blown up the brewery outside of town, and the beer was not as available as it once was. So, but it was accessible, is my point. Now, a few months later, that road was cut, and you could no longer take Highway 4 down to Kampong Som. And if you did, the chances of an ambush going through the mountain passes was fairly serious. And then one by one, I mean, I would get out. The way it worked, basically, you'd go to the briefing and you'd find out where the action was. And then I didn't have a car of my own, but the journalists that had more money than I did, because I was still freelance and doing this little radio network when I was there in 1970, those that had more money would have these old beaten up Mercedes Benzes, and they had Cambodian guides who were former Angkor Wat guides in the tourist industry, who had now become the assistants to journalists. And I would hitch a ride in one of the cars down Kampong Spur was a place that I recall going down to, some action down there. And we would go down and see how far we could go and then take a look around and come back. And of course, as time went on, that became more and more difficult and more dangerous. And as you said, I was going back and forth between Phnom Penh and Saigon as there were bigger stories happening in Vietnam, for example, the big 1972 offensive, where the North Vietnamese attacked Vietnam from three directions, including Cambodia. I was back on the northern front in Quang Tri and in the Central Highlands. So much of the period after Easter of 1972 was spent back in Vietnam, where the big stories were. And then by that time, I had gotten myself a much better job with much better money with NBC. So by 1972, I was much more I was less independent and much more preoccupied with building, if you will, a new career with the big network and NBC.
And I believe in the book there was a moment where it was a really good juxtaposition of sort of this these two different sides of Cambodia, where I believe you're at one of Sihanouk's daughter's birthday parties, so it's very easy to sort of imagine, you know, this upper crust, as it were, sipping champagne and talking about the things that they would talk about, and you'd sort of juxtapose that with what you were starting to see sort of filter into Cambodia. Like there are people trying to escape, but still, this, I don't want to say blind optimism. Let's just, yeah, we'll call it a positive
I
attitude
would,
at least. But yeah, how do you
I
reflect
would,
on that?
yeah, I would say, Lachlan, that there was a bubble, and you see this, I guess, in every war capital. You have this bubble of people who are sort of insulated from the war. The party that I was at was being given for the very famous ballet dancer Bopa Devi, and she was a daughter of Prince Sihanouk. A lovely, lovely woman, and this party was held just before she went off to Paris. She finally decided to leave Cambodia for a while. Didn't come back till much, much later. But she was a smart, elegant woman who I think was in denial about the war, as was everybody in that sort of, as you put it, upper crust of Phnom Penh society. I remember going to the old Cirque Sportif. The ironies of the Cirque Sportif are amazing. And I think maybe you've talked about this in your podcast, but the Cirque Sportif was the place to go for social activity. And it was buzzing all the time throughout the war. And then, of course, as we learned much, much later, it happened to be the execution grounds for the Khmer Rouge when they came to power. And now, of course, ironically, it's the big US embassy in Phnom Penh. But you would go to these parties and you'd see people who were still optimistic, still, I think, in denial. I mean, somebody like Bopa, I don't think she was really aware of what was really happening in the countryside. But she must have seen the refugees coming into the city. I mean, I remember, you know, when I first went to Phnom Penh, there were no beggars on the streets. There were beggars all over the place in Saigon, right? I mean, that's natural, I suppose, for many war situation. But when I came back in 70, 72, it was a very different situation. She must have seen that, but there still seemed to be this bubble and this denial among people in Phnom Penh.
Sort of disconnect. Well, I want to sort of move us forward just slightly to perhaps one of the most, well, I think at the time it was the most infamous sort of footage that we were getting out of Cambodia until less than a week later. But you were there on the ground about 5 days before the Khmer Rouge victory on the 17th of April 1975, and April 12th is another very important day in this story. Now, you were there on the ground, and your voice is actually will be very recognizable to anyone who has seen the reporting of that day.
Word that the U.S. was pulling out of Cambodia came early Saturday morning. American Marines were flown in from the USS aircraft carriers Okinawa and Hancock to carry out the helicopter lift. A school several blocks from the embassy served as the makeshift landing zone.
So I'm wondering, can you give us or the listeners a little bit of an insight into this is an extraordinary event, Operation Eagle Pool. What was that like from your perspective?
Well, let me go back a little bit on that because I flew into Phnom Penh from Paris. I was fairly late in getting there. It was early March that I arrived back in Phnom Penh in 1975, early March. And my main reason for going back, I had managed to persuade NBC to assign me there. My main reason was to try to get Sok Sinan, my friend, out of the country. She had resisted leaving Cambodia. It's like so many people, she believed that, we're all Khmer. We'll all work things out. Things will be fine in the end. I have my family here. I'm going to stay. And then there are other complications, which are all in the book, but other complications led her to want to stay. But my principal objective in going back to Phnom Penh at that time was to try to persuade her to leave. Anyway, the city that I saw, of course, was so different from the city that I had left. The last time I had seen it was in, I guess it was January of 73, was the last time I had seen Phnom Penh. And of course, it was swollen with refugees by, I think most estimates say maybe it was like 2.5 million people by this time. And all of the aid agencies were there. My first stop was CARE and Oxfam and a number of the other agencies that were UNICEF that were trying to care for people. I had a Cambodian doctor friend. I visited him to find out what conditions were in the hospitals, and all of it was pretty dreadful. And yet there was this feeling, well, if we can make it through the dry season, another dry season, we might make it through. And they seemed oblivious to the fact that Vietnam was falling apart next door. And so there was still, it would cling to this hope. I did not expect the Americans to pull out as quickly as they did. I would visit the embassy maybe once every day or once every other day. I got to know John Gunther Dean a bit, the ambassador. I had written a piece for the Far Eastern Economic Review in March, talking about his desire for a controlled solution. Of course, there was no controlled solution, but he had maybe wished it or was working for it anyway. And he called me in to talk about my article in which I sort of ridiculed the controlled solution idea. In any event, when it all happened, the word came to me. I was at the I was I just finished dinner with my friend, and went back to the Monorom Hotel, and my NBC producer was over at the Royal Hotel, and this was the night of the 11th of April, and the word came down that there was going to be an evacuation the following morning to get yourself ready and get to the embassy by, I believe it was, 8 a.m. I could not find my friend, but I certainly had secured a space for her on the helicopter evacuation. I must say I was in shock because I did not want to leave Cambodia either. And it was like leaving your lover, which is what I was doing. But I had to. I was the only correspondent there for NBC, had to be there on the story. I still have the clips from the time, which I'll show you later, but it was great boasting on the Americans' part about the Cambodian airlift. We were delivering to Phnom Penh food and supplies. It was equivalent to the Berlin airlift of years before. And then I have the from the U.S. Embassy, the last Situationer. April the 5th was one that I had. The mood in Phnom Penh is one of watchful waiting and a sense of resignation as the 5-year Cambodian drama is played out, the U.S. Embassy wrote. And then I have another one that was written right the day before, which still says, Cambodian troops are holding out on the outskirts of the city. So, and I get on that helicopter, and I must say, I have never seen, but before then or since then, the amount of emotion on this helicopter evacuation. Military attaché, who I had met, in tears, their, head in their hands, because they too were impacted by having to suddenly leave Cambodia. It was a very small evacuation, certainly very small compared to the enormous one that was to occur on April 30th in Saigon. But there were seats empty on the helicopters. You didn't see that in Vietnam. Cambodians who were asked to leave said, thank you, no thank you. And I still have the brochure, if I can find it here, of the helicopter. And they actually gave us a welcome aboard. And I can show you this later. Welcome aboard, Marine Helicopter Inc., nonstop to the Gulf of Thailand. And I was furious. I was, this is not a time to celebrate a U.S. Marine evacuation. This is a time of mourning. And I think all of those that are on the choppers that day felt that way. And clearly, once we were gone, it was going to be all over. But frankly, I was quite surprised because the Khmer Republic held on 13th, 14th, 15th, 16th to the 17th. And I was even surprised that for 4 or 5 days they could hold on. But those are my initial thoughts to your question. Operation, I'm not sure, we used to call it Operation, not Eagle Pull, but Turkey Trot or some such thing like that. To me, it was somewhat obscene, the evacuation, which, by the way, was one of my motivations for not going on the evacuation of Vietnam.
That's absolutely heartbreaking. So I guess the logical place to go then is for us to talk about, well, as you mentioned, you're not in Phnom Penh on the 17th of April, but obviously you're being made aware of what is going on there. But you do make the decision to stay on in Saigon. So I guess that sort of moves us into this latter part of our discussion here, mate, where I want to talk about your experience in Saigon as well as your experience in sort of seeing what was happening or hearing or reading what was happening in Cambodia. And I guess, yeah, I want to talk about your reflections there on the ground, as well as later we'll get to what you just mentioned, sort of this personal heartbreak and this personal experience. Like, you've come there with a job to do, but there's so much more than that. And that story continues 5, 10, 15, 50 years down the track to now. So, yeah, let's talk about Saigon. What do you think about that now, man?
When the Khmer Rouge took Phnom Penh, I was in Bangkok, and we were monitoring everything on the radio. That was our main source of news about the final capture of Phnom Penh. After that, with a great deal of sadness, I got on a plane, flew to first to the Philippines, because I wanted to check out some of the refugees that I knew were in the Philippines. And then I went to Hong Kong, and a fellow named Neil Davis, who was a great Australian camera person, journalist, a wonderful guy, and I hatched a plan to go to Vietnam and stay in Vietnam no matter what happened. I had two motivations. Number one, it was certainly going to be a good story. I had a lot of confidence in Neil. He was a guy about 10 years older than I was and very well experienced in Vietnam and Cambodia. And so I had that sense of confidence being with him. And then I also thought, perhaps, because I had heard that a number of Khmer refugees were coming out of Cambodia, getting into Vietnam. And there were a certain number that were able to escape to Vietnam prior to the complete domination by the Khmer Rouge of the entire country. And I had it in the back of my head that maybe my friend Sinan, maybe she might make it out to Vietnam. She had friends in Vietnam, and I had friends, I had a lot of friends in Saigon. And so I was That was my second reason for going there. So I was there. We didn't arrive in Saigon until the 25th, 26th of April, so only 4 days before the end there. And so Neil and I covered the final helicopter that left, and then the desperate people on the grounds in front on top of the U.S. Embassy in Saigon. And we were able to stay on. I was able to stay for roughly a month, and Neil stayed for about 3 months covering the communist victory.
We think that the American has some methods or find many ways to save us from the communists. We don't want to stay here anyway.
But do you know that all the Americans are gone?
Yes, I know that, but I must come in case, just in case.
But there's no way because all the helicopters are gone.
Can you help us?
The U.S. Embassy behind me has been completely looted. The South Vietnamese obviously are angry at the American withdrawal. Many of them have said that they were left out in the evacuation. They were unable to make the helicopters. Many of them were American employees. They have had to stay, and they will now have to stay and cope with communism in South Vietnam.
And of course, what's interesting about it is a lot of journalists fled Vietnam because of Cambodia. Their home offices in New York said, look what's happened in Cambodia. There seems to be a bloodbath going on there. All the journalists are being forced to be in the French embassy in Phnom Penh. We cannot have you, as a journalist, staying on in Saigon. Look what's going to happen. There's going to be a bloodbath. And it'll do you no good anyway if you're imprisoned in Saigon. You're not going to be able to do anything. Neil and I did not believe that. We reluctantly came to the conclusion that everything that was being said about the Khmer Rouge was true. But in terms of the Vietnamese had always been fairly savvy in their dealings with Western journalists. If they could persuade you that you were a progressive journalist and you could represent their story, then they were going to use you for that purpose. And we had all seen, Joan Baez and Jane Fonda and many others going off.
Wilfred Brochet had been there for how long?
Wilfred Brochet, of course, had been there for ages. But nobody seemed to have done that with the Khmer Rouge, but they've done it many times with the Vietnamese. So we figured that it'd be okay. Our biggest worry, frankly, were angry, disgruntled, feeling betrayed South Vietnamese who might take it out on foreigners. That was our bigger worry. As it happened, the South Vietnamese shed their uniforms and went into hiding if they could. And the second part of the story is there was really no bloodbath in Vietnam. Yes, there were arrests, registrations, re-education camps later on, but that all came a little bit later. The re-education camps were opened up in 76 and onward, and they were pretty bad, don't get me wrong, but it wasn't that way in the first month or two or three in Vietnam. So it was a very different experience. I'm glad that I stayed. Sadly, my friend did not come across the border into Vietnam, and there was no chance of rescuing her at that stage.
And what you've mentioned there is, I guess, sort of a little window into a quite large theme that many people who are familiar with Cambodian history from the outside will be aware of. I guess the biggest example would be through the film The Killing Fields, on this sort of role of the journalist within this much larger historical narrative. I'm wondering, I guess this could be incorporated into your sort of wider reflections from then to now, but how do you think about the differences there were between this group of journalists that were on the ground in Cambodia? I'm sure that you were friends or acquaintances with many of the names that people would be familiar with from that time. And how do you sort of think about the differences there that were in that the sort of different groups of journalists?
Well, the sad reality was among journalists is that if you were a star journalist or a senior journalist or a senior member of your newspaper, magazine, or broadcast network, you'd be in Vietnam, not Cambodia. Cambodia was and remained what Willie Shawcross called a sideshow. And it was a sideshow right up to the very end. So even, you know, luminaries like Sid Shanberg struggled to get his story told in the New York Times. And, you know, I remember, you know, in American television terms, if you were in Vietnam, you got the lead story. If you were in Cambodia, your story was buried somewhere down in the broadcast, or maybe not on the evening show at all, but relegated to a minor program. So Cambodia was, this sounds terrible to say, but the very best of American journalists, for example, were not in Cambodia. They were assigned to Vietnam. And it was a lot of young kids like myself who were in Cambodia, because if you were a senior guy, you'd be attached to, you know, I remember, for example, I had never interviewed in Vietnam an American officer above the rank of colonel. That was left to the senior guys. They would do the profiles of General Abrams or whatever, but not, I never met anybody in command. I was a little guy. So I would do grunt stories, Vietnamese stories, Khmer stories, ground level stories, even the slice of life stories. So it was a very different situation. I think it was true of many of those who were in Cambodia. They were not necessarily the senior people that were covering the war in Cambodia.
Brilliant. And I guess to sort of round this out, Matt, we've got this year we had the 50th anniversary of both the fall of Saigon and Phnom Penh. And that certainly 50 years ago was not the end of the story for yourself. You've gone back many times in the intervening years. I'm more or less just hoping to tee you off on that one, mate. And just, I don't know, so few people would have been able to see the different things that you've seen over this amount of time. And I'm wondering just if you wanted to just talk about that in any way you wanted to talk about, particularly given how recently you've been back for this latest anniversary.
Sure. My most recent visit to Vietnam was just last month in April for the enormous anniversary celebrations that they had for 50 years since the Yaiphong, or Liberation of Saigon, as they called it. And I was awestruck by how much effort they had put into this massive parade and all of the hoopla. And I was struck by the excitement in Saigon. But I think it was more, they were not celebrating the end of the war. They were celebrating the fact that they have done very well, particularly in the last 10, 15 years, in their economy and how they've built a pretty vibrant little nation. I'm not so sure it's the same next door in Cambodia. I did not get back to Cambodia on this particular trip. I have been in Cambodia in 2024 and 2023. And when I go back to Cambodia these days, and I could be wrong about this, people who live there can tell me that I'm an idiot, but I get a sense of a permanent post-traumatic stress syndrome situation in Cambodia, that things have never quite, you know, corruption has replaced the Khmer Rouge to a much larger degree than in Vietnam. There's plenty of corruption, of course, in Vietnam. It's still a growth industry, but not nearly to the degree in Cambodia. And I just find Cambodia a sadder place. Yes, they have had reasonable economic growth in recent years, but a sadder place. But my most striking revisit to Cambodia after the Khmer Rouge were deposed by the Vietnamese, my most striking visit was in 1979. I went in at the behest of the Vietnamese, and then I was able to go several times back into Phnom Penh between early April of 79 and up to January of 1980. I was going back and forth in, did a documentary film during that period, and also managed to help my friend who had survived the Khmer Rouge period. And of course, that was the most devastating period for me, seeing what had happened to Cambodia after the 4 years plus of the Khmer Rouge. And that was really hard. You had a podcast recently in which you talked about how people, the old people of Phnom Penh, managed to get back into the city. And I was actually a witness to what you were talking about. They were large groups of Khmer on the outskirts of the city, and the Vietnamese were sort of filtering them back into the city. And as you said, very few got their old houses back, but they did get back into the city and they tried to build new lives again. That is, if they could reunite with their families. In many cases, they had lost brothers and sisters and children and parents, and it was very hard to put things back together again. But I was a witness to this painful process of trying to put things back together again. And it was indeed a painful process. And I remember most strikingly, these are people that had, many of them had contacts in the outside world, in Europe, Australia, America, wherever, and they had not been able to send out a message from 1975 to 1979. All of a sudden, they're coming to me with letters. Please take this letter out, send it to my relative in Belgium or in France or in America. Tell them I am still alive. And that was absolutely shattering for me to do. And I did it. And I took the trouble of trying to get back to each and every person that had gone through me to say, here is what has happened. And that was my most indelible visit back to Cambodia.
That's absolutely incredible. So I think we're just about out of time here, Jim, and I want to just make sure that everyone knows that we've barely scratched the surface of both your story and what is really a dual narrative that you've put together in your book, The Last Helicopter.
The book?
There it is, right there, the very handsome young Jim on the cover. Did you want to just basically, I guess, tell people a little bit about sort of where you're at now, any places that they want to come and find you or follow you, or indeed anything about the book that you wanted to share with us?
Well, just briefly, I still do a lot of traveling. I'll be back in Vietnam at the end of this year, and then I'll be in Cambodia in early 2026. And so I'm keen to meet anybody I can. I was in Siem Reap to Angkor only briefly last year. Didn't have time to see anybody, but I hope to be able to spend some more time in early 26 in Cambodia. You can check on my schedule through any one of my social media platforms. I do a lot of speaking, and I'll be doing a lot of speaking about Cambodia and Vietnam in the course of the next year.
Thank you so much for that, Jim. All right. Well, I hope to talk to you again and maybe even see you in Cambodia one day. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you. Thank you, Lon. Thank you very much.
Brilliant.